Joseph Stalin was one of the great monsters of history, a ruthless tyrant responsible for at least 20 million Soviet deaths. What was it about his formative years that led him to become such a ruthless dictator? Young Stalin, a new book by Simon Sebag Montefiore, sheds light into that fascinating period of his life. The book is published by Vintage, and I'm joined now by Mr. Montefiore. Welcome back to our show.
Hi, great to be here.
And congratulations. The book's already won 4 prizes around the world.
That's right. Well, it won the LA Times book prize here, but it's just won a big French prize, which is very exciting.
Did this book grow out of the questions that you were asking yourself when you were writing your previous book on Stalin?
Absolutely. I mean, no one had really written about young Stalin before, because it was felt there was no material, and what material there was invented by Stalin. But as it turned out, I found that as many lies in the pro-Stalin propaganda as there was in the anti-Stalin propaganda by exiles and by Trotsky. And what I was amazingly lucky to find was that in the Moscow archives, I found a lot of new stuff that we didn't know about. But in the Georgian archives in Tbilisi, in Stalin's homeland, I found amazing new materials, like about Stalin's mother's memoirs and so on.
His mother's memoirs were there, not in Gori, his hometown.
Not in Gori, but actually in Tbilisi. And bizarrely, Stalin had actually banned his mother from giving any interviews or talking to anybody, because journalists kept going down there and interviewing her. I mean, Soviet journalists, and writing about asking stupid questions like, what was it like to look after the great genius in his childhood. And Stalin was outraged by this sort of thing and banned it. But Stalin's mother, at a great old age, decided to do it herself. And I found in the Georgian archives a 17-page type document dictated by her, which really shows the real Stalin.
Now, Gori has been in the news recently as a town at the center of the Ossetian conflict between Russia and Georgia. What was it like in the late 1800s?
Oh, I mean, it was a wild city. It was famous for having organized brawls in which the whole town would get drunk on religious festivals, and then everybody of every age. So, like, toddlers would fight toddlers, men would fight, grown men would fight grown men, teenagers, and the Russian police and army would just withdraw to barracks and kind of only come out in the morning.
Did Georgians already aspire to gain independence at that time?
Absolutely. I mean, Stalin's grandfather and great-grandfather were both Georgian freedom fighters. And, it had only been in the empire for sort of 70 or 80 years when he was born.
So it's kind of ironic that Stalin turned out the way he was, a man who definitely kept the Soviet empire together and would have killed an awful lot of people if any Georgian insurgent movement had developed.
Well, he did. He killed a lot of Georgians, you're so right. I mean, the irony of it, Stalin today, is that, in present-day Russia, we think of Stalin over here as, a Marxist cobbler's son from Georgia who became a Soviet communist dictator. But that's kind of irrelevant now. What's relevant now is that, in Prime Minister Putin's Russia to the Kremlin there, he is now a Red Tsar. He is now the greatest emperor of Russia in the 20th century.
Earlier this year, in an online poll to name Russia's greatest man, he took an early lead, and he is likely to have won if the poll's administrators hadn't cut his votes in half. And even with those votes cut in half, Stalin still managed to take 12th place.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he was actually basically the winner if it hadn't been for. But the interesting thing is that he's come to represent to Russians, and especially to the Russian government, he's come to represent, well, I mean, put it like this, President Putin just about 3 months ago unveiled a new textbook for Russian history teachers, and did it officially in the Kremlin. And when he gave them the document, the actual history book says Stalin was the most successful Russian ruler of the 20th century.
Because Stalin believed in the ends justifying the means, and that is now the way people are thinking in Russia?
Well, he made Russia strong. What people are thinking about now is, they want a strong Russia, a Russia that's an equal to America, a Russia that's restored in pride and wealth. And the Russian economy in some ways is very oil-based, but they do have these colossal reserves now. So Russia's pretty strong at the moment.
Now, you mentioned his father being a cobbler. Do we really know who his father was?
Well, in the book, I've really for the first time found, photographs and everything of all the sort of potential. There were three main candidates for his for being his father, apart from his real father.
His mother was promiscuous.
I don't think she was promiscuous. I think that what happened was that she was married to... She was a very attractive, spirited, ambitious woman. She was very attracted. She was a very attractive person. And she was married to a violent alcoholic drunk. So that, you know, I think when her marriage deteriorated, she had a protector. And I don't think that... That was quite shocking probably for that time, but I don't think she was promiscuous.
Well, you have to wonder what it was like to grow up in that kind of chaotic home with a father who's not around all that much and is a violent alcoholic,
a mother
who did have other male friends. You detail the illegitimate children that Stalin fathered and the string of girlfriends he abandoned. Do you think that those attitudes grew out of what he saw when he was a kid?
Well, I think one can overstress this. I mean, people like Hitler and Saddam Hussein and Stalin all had unhappy childhoods and were beaten as children and had alcoholic fathers or whatever. But so do millions of people. And you've got to realize that Stalin grew up in a very violent world where violence was part of the daily life. But that wasn't in itself enough either. He then embraced Marxism. And that was really the key thing, where Marxism, the Bolsheviks really did believe in terror, and they were terrorists. And you could read this book. I mean, this book starts with his big bank robbery. And Miramax, in fact, are making a movie of this now, which is kind of exciting. But in one sense, you can read this book just as an adventure story. I mean, he had such an adventurous life. He escaped from prisons. It was, you know, one reviewer said it was like an Alexander Dumas novel. You can read it like that. But you can read it as what's made Stalin into Stalin, what made the Soviet Union into the Soviet Union too.
Well, he grew up in poverty, and that probably would lead him toward thinking about Marxism. But he was sent to a seminary to study at a young age, and wasn't that rather rare for someone who was as poor as he was?
Yeah, I mean, he got into the seminary. He was like a scholar all the way through his childhood. I mean, everyone he met, everywhere he went, people sort of recognized that this was an exceptional child and did everything they could to finance him, to get him into these schools. I mean, so he went into the elite school, the church school, which was the best school in Gori. Then he went to the best school in the whole of the Caucasus and the whole of South Russia, actually, which was this seminary in Tbilisi.
But it was expensive.
It was expensive. And even though they waived all sorts of fees for him, you had to buy the uniform. And his family literally didn't even have that. So the mother went around to all these powerful people, the local police chief, and everyone helped and paid for bits of... There was even a prince, one of the local princes, who paid for some of Stalin's education.
Well, the official communism was atheistic, so how did going to a seminary affect his views on religion?
Hugely. I mean, in two different ways. I mean, in one sense, it appalled him and disgusted him, because these seminaries were sort of... There was an enormous amount of violent homosexuality, corrupt priests, ludicrous over-supervision of children, raids on their sort of rooms to catch them with illegal literature. All literature was banned. You couldn't even read, you know, you couldn't even read Victor Hugo without having your room raided by priests in the middle of the night. So it was absurd. On the other hand, it gave him a vocabulary, a rhythm, a view of the world that he never lost and which he recreated in the Soviet Union.
But, isn't there some irony in the fact that he had this over surveillance? There was a priest he called Black Spot.
That's right.
Who seemed to be running the equivalent of a police state. You would have thought that Stalin would have wanted the exact opposite if he came to power.
Yeah, in fact, it must have deeply impressed him. And, in fact, he talked all his life about the priesthood. He was fascinated by priests. And several of the other Soviet leaders were also priests, had also studied for the priesthood. And they constantly talked about priests. And in fact, even while they were arresting and shooting priests, they were also, they used to sing, you know, hymns from the seminary. You know, in the Politburo used to sing them beautifully.
And you get a feeling that he was ambivalent toward other religions as well. There are these different times in his life when he suddenly becomes anti-Semitic, and you wonder whether that grows out of the kind of thing that he might have learned at the seminary.
I mean, one thing that he came out of, one thing that goes all through the lives of these people like Stalin is that, you know, first of all, violence and human life he regarded as absolutely, you know, a political tool to be destroyed, you know, at random. I mean, he even said, you know, in our system, we get things done, we shed blood. But on the other hand, he regarded himself as a sort of Jesus-like figure from childhood. And that's one of the great lessons of this young Stalin.
My guest is Simon Sebag Montefiore. His latest book, Young Stalin, published by Vintage, winner of any number of awards, including Los Angeles Times Book Prize for biography. He became politicized while he was in the seminary, but he could have done many different things. You say that he was a published poet. He was good enough as a singer to go professional as well. And yet, not long after he leaves the seminary, he becomes what you describe as a terrorist gangster.
Yeah, I mean, the poetry was actually extremely good. I mean, you've got to realize, like, as a 17-year-old boy, he wrote all this poetry, which in Georgian is apparently exquisite. I mean, it's not brilliant, but it's beautifully done. He walked into the editor of the local equivalent of the New Yorker, you know, in the Caucasus, and who was a very famous, important prince and also a great literary figure, and said, "These are my poems. I'd like you to publish them." You know. And the guy read them and said, "Actually, I think these are brilliant. I'm going to publish them." So they were published in this famous journal, like the, you know, if you imagine the New Yorker. So, you know, that was something.
It was like young Mao coming to the New Yorker and saying, "I have some poems."
Exactly. This kind of scruffy boy comes in there, and this guy looks and is amazed, but he publishes them. So interesting. But you're absolutely right. I mean, he became this kind of gangster terrorist boss.
But I get the feeling that people probably really thought he was brilliant, and he developed a pretty big sense of self.
Yeah.
As a result of that, you keep on being told, "Oh, you could do this, you could do that. You're the smartest kid in the school." So you really start believing in your own PR.
That's right.
Is that happening? Is that what happened here?
Yeah, I think so. But also, you know, once he was a very old man, peculiar man. And one of the clever things he said, he said lots of interesting things, was that all politicians are abnormal. And we know that's true.
Well, when he became this terrorist gangster, as you described him, what was he doing? What were his ambitions at that time?
Well, I mean, his ambitions were really to raise money for the Bolshevik Party. And that meant these huge bank robberies of ships, where they held them up as pirates. And he may well have led one of these pirate holdups on the Black Sea. And also these huge bank robberies, which are really like a sort of, they're on horseback. And the stagecoaches are on horseback. So it's really like sort of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
And he had 160 aliases. Was this around the time that he stopped being Soso Djugashvili and became Joseph Stalin?
Yeah, I mean, he became Stalin in 1912, began to be. But even in 1917, you know, he was still known as Djugashvili Stalin, and he hadn't quite decided on the name. And he was a very peculiar man, I mean, but he was expert. His natural habitat was the underworld, the underground. And if you wanted to get someone assassinated, hold up a bank, hold up a ship, or kill someone who'd been who you thought might be a traitor, he was the man. And that's why in 1917, when Lenin needed to be smuggled out of St. Petersburg during the revolution, you know, he didn't turn to any of the other intellectuals around him. He said, "Get me Stalin, he'll organize it," and he did.
So he was already recognized as a leader. And do you think that leadership style that he used during these years was something he continued to use when he became the Soviet leader?
That's the key thing. I mean, you know, the Russian Revolution could have gone another way, and they could have had ordinary politicians running it. But because they were so beleaguered, and because they were besieged, and because the regime was so tiny and controlling such a vast area in a war situation, they needed a guy who was an expert at repression, secret business, and that was Stalin.
And the sense is that there's a paranoia there, and he was brilliant at playing one side off against the other.
Yeah, he was always a natural politician. He always was. He was both super arrogant and also had a chip on his shoulder, and he was expert at sort of all in sort of secret politics, intrigue. He was a gifted man. He was a gifted man.
Well, you say that Lenin recognized those gifts. What was his relationship like with Lenin?
At first, very good. I mean, Lenin, you know, someone complained to Lenin that this guy was killing people and raiding banks and stuff. And Lenin laughed and just said, "That's exactly the type of man I need." And he recognized very early on that Trotsky and Stalin were the two most talented. And of course, the orthodoxy has always been, you know, we've always read in all these history books that we read that, like, Trotsky was so talented and all these other people were so talented, but Stalin was, he was some sort of, you know, he was some sort of useless mediocrity.
A thug.
A thug and a mediocrity and a grey man, and none of this was true. And, you know, Lenin immediately recognized that these were the two guys who could get stuff done.
Well, what did he think of Trotsky? What did Stalin think?
Hated him on sight.
Later, Stalin seemed to become anti-Semitic. There was the doctor's plot and other things. Was that at all a factor in his dealings with Trotsky in the early days?
Sure. I mean, Stalin immediately came into contact with all these kind of very confident, glamorous Jewish intellectuals who were like Trotsky, who was sort of dashingly handsome, dressed beautifully, could write funny articles, and were very much... I mean, also, you've got to realize that Trotsky came from a very wealthy home. I mean, his father was the equivalent of a multi-millionaire tenant farmer with huge estates. So Trotsky had a private income, he could buy nice clothes, and so there were real class divisions within the Bolsheviks, which we know which wasn't really known before.
In 1914, Stalin was captured and sent to Siberia to live in exile. He'd been betrayed by Roman Malinovsky, his friend and a Bolshevik in the Duma. Another irony here.
Yeah. I mean, the irony... I mean,
Stalin sent so many people to Siberia later, to the
gulags.
That's
right. And, of course, Siberia really made him into a Russian, made him into Stalin that we know. It gave him some ice in his heart.
Did he have a Georgian accent?
Yeah, he spoke in a thick Georgian accent all through his life. He loved Georgian food. He remained a Georgian. But he also created a powerful Russia and became a Russian nationalist.
You end the book with Stalin's taking power. How did he conduct himself during the years Lenin was in power that allowed him to become Lenin's successor of all the possible successes?
Well, I mean, the reason why Lenin denounced him before he died and tried to undermine him in his testament was because he recognized that Stalin was rapidly becoming the most obvious successor. But he behaved like he always behaved, with obstreperous obstinacy, rudeness when he needed to be, but also a brilliant ability to charm people when he wanted to. And in a sense, this was like normal politics. It was sort of Tammany Hall politics, you know, smoky rooms where you kind of charm people. I mean, when Stalin wanted to win over someone, you know, he would turn up at their apartment and check that the hot water worked, you know, and if it didn't, he'd have it mended. He'd ask their wives, you know, if you've got everything you need, is your kitchen okay? Do you want another limousine? You know, so he was a master of sort of what we'd call Tammany Hall politics.
Or Tip O'Neill, politics is local.
Yeah. He was a master. He was a people person. That's the irony.
And this book hasn't been released in Russia yet.
No, but the irony of it is that Russia, they hated Stalin, the court of the Red Tsar, but they like this because it shows Stalin as an exceptional person. So ironically, it's being published by the publishing house owned by one of the ministers in the government.
You have another book that's also being published by Simon & Schuster called Sashenka.
Sashenka is just out, and it's a novel, and it's set... It's a story of a woman and a Jewish-Russian family across the 20th century. And it's set, the first part set in wealthy St. Petersburg, the second part in Stalin's inner circle, and the third part in the swaggering, oil-rich, glitzy Moscow of the oligarchs today.
How did you become an expert on the early Soviet Union?
I was always fascinated by it, as a child. My mother's family came from Russia. And so I grew up among these sort of characters. And in fact, in Sashenka, the novel, you know, this family with all these kind of outlandish Jewish Russian characters is very much a world that I know. But it's a novel that you can learn a lot about Russia in it. All the history is accurate. But really, it's just an intimate story about a family, a tragic story of sort of love and betrayal. And I've written it, so it's very accessible. And everyone who reads it says that they end up crying at the end. So,
well, we have very little time, but I want to go back to something you said earlier. Many people grow up in families that are dysfunctional and then have troubled youths, and they don't wind up becoming dictators who kill 20 or more billion people. Is there something that we should understand about Stalin's background?
I don't think it's so much the background. I think you've got to look at... I always think it's wrong almost to dwell on the individual, though, of course, I'm a biographer, so I do. But actually...
You mean to psychologize.
We psychologize it. We look at the childhood and stuff. I mean, like I said, it was an amazing adventurous youth with violence as part of its coinage, violence and ideology. But I think what one has to look at actually is the ideology and the fact that words really matter in politics. I mean, they always said that they believed in terror and killing, as Hitler did, and no one believed them. And I think we've got to look at that.
Simon Sebag Montefiore's Young Stalin is now available in paperback from Vintage. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Great to be here, Leonard. Thanks.